The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Well, good morning, everyone. So in thinking about what to do today, I had two ideas. And one was to bring up a topic for you to discuss among yourselves, since we don't do that very often here, chance to talk and get to know each other about something in the Dharma. And the other was to take questions from you and have a kind of dialogue, because I'm aware that for many Sundays in a row that I've been here, I've given talks and had very little chance for questions and answers, and I appreciate a lot hearing what people's questions are and concerns, and rather than guessing what's useful. And whenever I ask which of those kind of two options people want to do, people seldom want to talk to each other. though it's a very useful thing to do in a community of, you know, in a community like ours, and to share the Dharma and explore it. Should we take a vote, or should we? Should I just assume that I know the answer? How many would like to have a discussion topic among yourselves? And how many would like to have questions? Okay, well, I think that's where the vote is. So those of you who raised your hands at first, why don't you stay after? We'll form a little group. It is important, this idea of, so, you know, if we were a little bit fewer people today, I would have had the small group thing, because it's really invaluable for people to have a chance to share, get to know each other and the Dharma and the practice. And we do a lot of that Fridays and Dharma practice days. So, especially, I don't know, now the people who raised their hands for questions, I hope you have some. So what, anybody like to ask something or bring up a topic? Yes, and if you could use the mic, please, can we pass it here?
I guess I'm just curious about your personal experience as you know, just granted that you're a teacher, how has meditating benefited you, and what is your experience while you're meditating, like in specifics?
So how has meditation benefited me, and what happens to me when I meditate? I've been meditating since I was 20. And the first few years, maybe 3 years or so, I was kind of halting on and off that I meditated. And then I think when I was about 22 or 23 is when I kind of just started doing it every day and it became a regular part of my life ever since. But when I think back at my, the time just before I started meditating and the first years of my meditation practice, I had a lot of personal difficulties, which I don't feel like I have anymore. I was anxious. I was very shy. I was plagued by a sense of guilt that didn't require me to do anything to have. Guilt by default. I had difficulties with relationships with other people and friendships and a variety of things. And so it was not a happy mind to be in. And I don't have any of that anymore. I feel happy and peaceful, and mostly my relationship with people are nice. The whole people thing is difficult, right? For everybody, but sometimes it goes better than other times. But I don't feel anxious about it, and so I feel it's a huge change. I feel peaceful, mostly happy, especially if I don't do much. Like the more that's the default for me. Sometimes I do a lot of stuff, and I forget to be happy because I'm so busy doing my thing. But I like doing things. I kind of, you know, so I like to be involved and engaged, and so I'm on. I think I have a much higher degree of mindfulness than I had before. It's kind of second nature to me, kind of be mindful, to monitor myself, to kind of sense what's going on. I don't think I think about so much about being mindful. In fact, when I try to be mindful in a conscious, intentional way, it just seems like a burden, just like extra activity. But kind of like there's a constant state of attentiveness, not constant, maybe I'm saying too much, but, you know, it's a kind of a state that I'm in of being attentive, being mindful, being present for my body and what's going on here. So it's kind of second nature. It's kind of one of the things that's happened through all this. So that's some of the things that's happened. I could go on, it would bore you. And what's my experience of meditation now? That changes from day to day. It depends a lot what's going on in my daily life. So it isn't like I can sit down and meditate and boom, you know, it's like always the same thing. Some days my mind is busy and I have a lot of thoughts. Sometimes I have very, very little thoughts when I sit down to meditate. Sometimes there's settling some of the kind of tensions of the day. I've been busy doing a lot of things, whatever, or dealing with things which are a little bit agitating or something. And so then it's a kind of a settling process that goes on. Sometimes I sit down and I can settle in relatively quickly to a fairly concentrated state, and I feel very happy. You know, there's kind of a lot of happiness that comes along. If I sit long enough, that happiness goes further into deeper and deeper states of peace and well-being. But, you know, it varies from day to day. So those are some of the things that occurs to me. What did you ask?
Why do I ask? Well, curious because, you know, you're so experienced. You've been doing it for a while, and you're the teacher. You know, some of the small little sparks of things that start to happen for me, or I don't know if I'm speaking for all of us or not, but I wonder, you know, what is the potential for myself or the rest of us who might be beginners to reach?
So maybe, being a teacher, I'm supposed to be a little bit an example of what's possible, I suppose, of what I teach. So maybe that's a, so it's a fair question to ask them in that case.
Better a cautionary tale.
Part of the risk with using a teacher, you know, I think teachers and, you know, not just teachers, but other people who practice for a long time are very important inspirations. And I know for me that it was very important for me. I probably couldn't have practiced as much as I did without models of other people who are practicing. Not always teachers, but... But other practitioners, the long-time practitioners. But part of the danger of using anyone as a model, you can be inspired by people, but you want to be a little bit careful you're not trying to become that like that person. When I was first at Zen Center, San Francisco Zen Center, as a new student, I had this idea of what the perfect Zen student was supposed to be like. And it was one of the teachers there who I really admired a lot. I had a lot of respect for him. Some of you might have known him, Ed Brown. He's still a wonderful man. But he was one of the senior teachers when I first came to Zen Center. And I looked up to him. And as a result of that, I thought that that's what I was supposed to be if I was a good Zen student. I was supposed to become like Ed Brown. And then I bake some bread. and I did at Zen Center. and then I went away for a while and I came back. And then when I came back to be at Zen Center, there was a Zen priest teacher there who I hadn't met before named Philip Whalen. Philip Whalen was one of the, I don't know, great beatnik poets in the 50s who... you know, the circle of Allen Ginsberg and those people, Jack Kornfield, and Kerouac and people. And he became a Zen priest and a teacher there. And he was kind of, I don't know what to say, but some of you know the Chinese statues of Ho Toi, you know, maybe a little bit like that. And he didn't look, you know, like Ed Brown. And I walked to breakfast one day at Zen Center, and there he was eating breakfast, reading the newspaper. And I looked at that, and I said, well, that's not what Ed Brown would do. That's not like just like this dynamic, one thing only, fully engaged in what you're doing kind of idea, you know. So I asked him, you know, what are you doing? You're supposed to be here. And so eventually, what I learned was that point wasn't to be like Ed Brown. And one of the things I teach in Zen is Zen is Zen when you're yourself. So I say this, you know, people look like, you know, looking at me, you know, it's possible I'm kind of peculiar. I know I'm peculiar. And so maybe, you know, I tend to be kind of even-keeled emotionally. I tend to be a little bit calm or something. I tend to be a little bit aloof, you know, a little bit aloof from people a little bit. I don't connect that, you know, readily sometimes. So that doesn't mean you're supposed to be this way. You know, you have a whole different way of being. So part of, I think, what this mindfulness can do is, I think, a very important part of mindfulness for almost every endeavor that we engage in our life is to become mindful of how we get in the way of doing the activity, how we interfere, how we complicate it unnecessarily, the unnecessary complications that we add on top of whatever we're doing can fall away because we see them. And part of the unnecessary complications is trying to be someone we're not. And so as we see ourselves and be ourselves more and see the unnecessary ways in which we add, things fall away and fall away until you get to be yourself more. And I think that's good news. I don't know what you think. So that was a long answer. Yes, straight.
Just recently, I put a few things together just as ideas. I was watching Charlie Rose about 2 weeks ago, and the Biz Stone and the other fellow who founded Twitter reported that they had just made a contract with the school system of Peru, the country of Peru, on the Pacific Ocean, just south of us. Peru, the country is just south of us. The Twitter has made a contract to completely revise the educational system of Peru. And so as a result, it's easy for us, with all our individual abilities, knowledge, skills, compassion, to possibly quickly expand Twitter to help Peru get knowledge. They're certainly needy of our help. Thank you.
Thank you. So we can pan back here to maybe on the stage. Oh, go ahead.
Yes, I'm trying to be mindful, not to be anxious to ask you. I'm trying to be mindful in everything I do, and sometimes I realize that I say something or do or make a mistake, which is in a case where I'm not too mindful. So how would you deal with moments like that when you say something or made a mistake where you're not mindful, and then later you realize, wow, I wasn't being mindful at that time?
Well, if you hurt someone, it's good to apologize. If that's what kind of mistakes are you talking about?
Yes, I guess that's one of the mistakes. Maybe you say something, I don't know, maybe something silly or something that is not appropriate to at the moment. Or maybe, for example, let's say I was supposed to do something and I didn't do it right. I missed my task that I was supposed to do because I didn't realize the instructions were in front of me.
Right.
Because I assumed that I knew what I needed to do. So I got in trouble with the person who gave me those instructions. Mm-hmm. So how... how would I deal with that kind of mistake where I wasn't being mindful to follow?
Yeah, I think there's a variety of things that you can do. I think that it's pretty normal in human life to make mistakes. I don't think we should be afraid of making mistakes all the time. We should be concerned about not hurting people. But if we're, I think an important part of mistakes is, and the important relationship we can have with them is to learn from them. So if you've done something which you call a mistake, I think one of the tasks then is what can I learn about myself? Not to be weighed down by the past, but rather to study the past, study what you did and what happened, look inside yourself, and then see what can I learn from that situation? What led to that mistake? How was I that I made that mistake? What was going on internally? What was going on externally? and how can I learn to do better in the future so I don't make this mistake again? And so that's one thing we can learn. The other thing we can learn with mistakes is how we relate to mistakes. If a person makes a mistake, and then gets overwhelmingly angry, overwhelmingly distressed by having made that mistake, then perhaps there's some deeper issue of attachment to something which is operating. It'd be good to look at. And one of the interesting things to look at is our whole relationship to our self-identity, the way in which we represent ourselves to ourselves, represent ourselves to the world. And sometimes the self-representation phenomena that humans do can be overly done. We could really overly attach to it. It looms much bigger than it needs to be. And so the issue and mistake is not the mistake in and of itself, but the tremendous distress perhaps about now people are not going to like me. Now, I'm not living up to some ideal standard which I think I'm supposed to live up to. And so our whole relationship to mistakes is part of what we study and understand well. And perhaps there's a simpler, easier way to be with mistakes, that we don't get burdened by it. It doesn't have to tie into our self-identity issues in some big way. And so that's two things about mistakes. The third thing you can do with mindfulness is you can look around and see what are the consequences of the mistake you made in the situation itself, in the people it's affected by the mistake, and in yourself. And what remedy is needed? There's plenty of situations in life where the remedy is not more mindfulness. Because mindfulness is good, but it can be overrated if that's all we're going to do. Sometimes real-world changes are needed. And so making an apology or going make amends for the mistake or fix the mistake if that's what's appropriate to do. Or as I've said before, some mistakes can't be fixed or don't need apologies, but we can learn from them and try to do better in the future from it. So those are some things that occur to me. How does that speak to you, to your question?
That's what I thought you would say. But I just wanted assurance.
Oh, you want to be reassured. So is that reassuring? So here, Ellen has had her hand up for a while. On the stage up there. And maybe, Dante, could you take yours and pass it back in some direction? And we can.
Along the lines of the first person who asked you a question, I've been curious about, but I want to give you permission to say it's none of our business. So when I ask the question. And that what I'm curious about is what led you to leave being a Zen, priest, and then led you from Zen to insight meditation.
Okay, yeah, that's it's a pretty common question. People know a little bit of my history. It's a reasonable question. I believe I gave a kind of a talk on that on some December, 3-4 years ago. I have no idea what the talk was titled or anything, but so for now. I was very happy practicing Zen. I was a Zen priest and practicing Zen center, and I was being Zen priest or Zen monk. I was very happy with that lifestyle. I was engaged. I the whole practice, the philosophy, the approach of life was very meaningful for me. And I had no thoughts of doing something else. Except at some point, life at the San Francisco Zen Center for me started to feel a little bit too insulated or narrow, and I felt the need to kind of get some fresh perspective. And so the fresh perspective for me was to go to Japan, to go to Zen monastery there, to practice in Japan, you know, to get back to the source or the. So I went to Japan for a year, and while I was practicing in Japan, I entered Japan on a tourist visa. I was there for three months, so I had to get a longer visa. And I kind of knew that when I got my ticket from San Francisco to Japan that I had to leave to get a new visa. You have to leave the country to get the new visa and come back in. And it turned out for something like only $50 more, if I paid $50 more, I was going to get a round-trip ticket from San Francisco to Tokyo, I think. But for $50 more, I could get a round-trip ticket to Bangkok with two free stopovers in Japan. So that was a good deal, since I knew I had to leave the country. So I did that, so I had this ticket to Bangkok, and so I had to go to Bangkok to get the new visa, and then I had to wait for the visa, and so what does a Zen priest do in Thailand, I was kind of interested in some of the traditional Buddhist teachings that were still, like the Abhidharma, that were still alive and active in Thailand. So, I was on the airplane. I didn't know anything, really, hardly anything. Didn't even know where I was going to stay that night when I arrived. But I was thinking, well, what should I do? I have two choices. I could either go travel around to as many monasteries and temples as I could and just ask questions and learn from different teachers, or I can go to one place and say I'm here and just tell me what to do and I'll meditate and just go deeply in one place. So that's what I chose to do, somehow my visa never came. I was waiting for it, and so I showed up to this monastery and I said, I'm here to meditate, to do your thing here. And so they said, okay, here's a little what's called a kuti, a little one room cabin in the edge of the monastery, and you just go out there and meditate all day and come see me tomorrow. I'll give you more instructions. And I did that, and then the next day with more instructions, go back and forth. And so I was just doing this practice, all day long, meditating. And in Zen, the longest time we meditated for all day long was 7 days. And so after 7 days, then it became 14 days and 21 days. And it went on this way, just on and on and on. Until after 10 weeks, I decided the visa wasn't going to come. But in those 10 weeks, I was just on an intensive retreat. It's all I did: sitting and walking, meditation all day long, and it was much longer than I ever did in Zen. And I think the length of time of it allowed me to get more settled and more concentrated than I ever had been in my Zen practice. And there was something about the depth of what I touched in that concentrated state, stillness, that became very essential. Very important when I left that Thailand, became very important for me to go touch that depth of that place again. It was the only thing that became important for me. It was became almost like a little bit like a dark night of the soul time, because I was not, I was removed or separated from that place, and something in me had to go back to that depth of place. And it wasn't exactly the Vipassana practice that I was interested in, although, I liked it enough. It was kind of interesting. But it was the opportunity to touch that place. I went back to Japan and to do a 5-month retreat at a Zen monastery there. And it was a little bit hard to be there because they didn't meditate very much. And I couldn't get back to that place. I couldn't touch it anymore. And so I came back to America, and then I had no more money. So I worked for a few months to try to get as much money as I could. And then as soon as I could, I went back to Southeast Asia. And then I did another one of these long retreats. I did an 8-month retreat this time, where all I did for 16 hours a day was to meditate. and for 8 months, and that was doing this Vipassana practice, and that two things about that. One, as I was doing that, the length of time made a big difference for me. And I could touch places I couldn't touch any other time. But the second time I was there, the instructions that I got helped me to understand how to bring meditation and mindfulness into a wider range of my life and my inner life than I'd ever learned in Zen. And so I started to see the value, and I really appreciated this Vipassana practice. But it was never like I left Zen. It was never like there's a problem with Zen, and here Vipassana is better. It's kind of like, some people are, Jewish and Buddhist, and that seems to be fine, right? And so I'm Zen and Vipassana. why not? I was still, I think Zen is a great practice, and I have a lot of respect and appreciation for it. But I really valued a lot what the Vipassana teachings did for me and my practice, the retreat practice, and the understanding that it comes in, the way it's held, the philosophy in which that practice is held. That's different than the philosophy of how Zen is held. And so when I came back to this country, I continued with... I went back to Zen Center for a year and was very happy living there for a year. And then I went to IMS to do a three-month retreat, Vipassana retreat. And then we did finish a three-month Vipassana retreat, and then I went and did a three-month Zen retreat at Tassajara. So I was going, back and forth. And so I wasn't like choosing one over the other. It wasn't like I had a career. It wasn't like I had anything to do. I mean, I had devoted my life to be a Buddhist practitioner. I was a Zen priest, a Zen monk. I spent a lot of time thinking about what I was going to do with my life, and I decided this is the most important thing for my life, was to engage in this Buddhist practice and try to support other people in it. And so, it wasn't like, it wasn't like I had anything else to do. So I followed my nose. I followed what was unfolding, what seemed important for me, and the next step in this journey that I was on. And so it took me back and forth between Zen and Vipassana in a very nice way. And I think they complemented each other very nicely for me. And then, after 10, is this going? Am I going on too much? Is it okay? Should I? Yeah. Maybe I've long since left your question. I'm trying to answer. And so then at this point I'd spent 10 years of my life living in either monasteries or intensive meditation centers, and probably hadn't spent more than, I don't think I spent at the longest more than 2 weeks away from a place like that in 10 years. And at some point I felt like I had finished a cycle or finished something about that phase of my life. It didn't seem appropriate anymore for me to be in these monasteries anymore, to do that kind of practice. And so here I was, what am I going to do instead? It's not like I'm going to go and, it wasn't like I had a job, a career to go back to, and I was. So, but I really, again, my commitment was Buddhism and supporting other people in practice, and so what am I going to do? And there weren't a lot of job opportunities to be a Zen priest in America then. So what do you do? So I decided that I would go and get a master's degree in Buddhist studies, with the idea that when I left the monastery, I could maybe teach Buddhist studies at a community college at least, and that way stay close to the Buddhism and do it. So I went and got a master's in 2 years in Buddhist studies. And at the end of those 2 years, I received a phone call from Jack Kornfield asking me if I would like to train to be a Vipassana teacher. And when I got that phone call, it was one of these remarkable experiences of my life, at least, where as he was talking to me on the phone, I had a visceral feeling of the puzzles of my life, the puzzle pieces, coming together and fitting. I can't explain to you exactly why that was, but it's a visceral click. Oh. And... And later, I kind of, when I was explaining myself to a friend, I said, what a great opportunity to study to be a teacher with Jack Kornfield. Even if I'm not going to be a teacher, I should do it. Because what a great thing. And so I agreed to do that. And then I came back to San Francisco. I was in Hawaii getting my master's, so I came back here. My professor in Hawaii really wanted me to go to PhD program. And I didn't, what am I going to, I didn't have anything going, right? There's nothing, so I wasn't coming back again, to a career or anything. So I'm beginning to sound like some kind of slacker. So I applied to two graduate programs in the Bay Area, and to my surprise, got accepted to both of them, and Stanford had the better scholarship, because I had no money, right? So they gave me this very nice scholarship that I could live on. And so I came back. I didn't expect to get accepted. I wasn't so invested in getting accepted. I was coming back to the Bay Area, but I got accepted, so then I went to Stanford. And then I came back and I lived at Zen Center for a year and started teacher training with Jack Kornfield, the Vipassana teacher. And while I was there at Zen Center, one of my primary Zen teacher sat down with me, or actually wasn't down, he went for a walk, and he said, what's up with you? And then we had, he said, what's your relationship to me? And I said, I trust you completely, but I don't always feel like we have the same understanding of the Dharma. So it's kind of like a big thing to say, right, to your teacher. there was this wonderful moment when I said that. He kind of stopped as we were on the sidewalk in San Francisco and turned to me. And I think he put his hands together like this. And he said, that's where we'll meet. that's where we'll meet. And that was great, that he, rather than being troubled by the fact that we had differences, like, that's great, we'll meet there. And then he said, kind of in the same walk, he said, why don't you start coming over to see me once a week to prepare to be trained to be a Zen teacher? And I said, let's not talk about that. but I'll come over every week and see you. So there I was. So it kind of became teacher training. So then there I was, I'd found myself in this situation of being trained by Jack Kornfield to be a Vipassana teacher, by trained by Mel Weitzman to be a Zen teacher, and getting a PhD in Buddhist study all at the same time. It's kind of ridiculous. So I kind of just stumble on it, just being a slacker, right? Just kind of. And so again, I'm saying all this, it's a long story, because the question of Zen and Vipassana, people assume you're choosing one over the other. But it kind of just evolved this way for me. The sense of it just evolved naturally, or kind of an easy way, and I didn't feel like I had to choose one over the other. And so then I continued, and I continue to this day be involved with the San Francisco Zen Center a little bit. It's an important place for me. I kind of value the people there and the community and the practice. It's pretty minimal, my involvement these days, but I still have a little thread of a connection. And then we had the sitting group in Palo Alto that I was asked to teach in 1990, that slowly, slowly grew to be this group. And then about 19... I don't know when it was, 1995, I was really impressed by the people who were coming and sitting every week and practicing, and really respected a lot their commitment to practice, the value they had, and the regularity of their practice. And I felt a responsibility to the group. And initially my idea about how to fulfill my responsibility was to let the group grow big enough so I can invite another teacher in so I could leave. I'm still letting it, still hoping. No. So So that was like one plan I had, because I didn't want to live in an urban environment like this. I had no interest. I always had an image of myself living in the country. And so then, but then the group grew, and I felt my commitment to the group grew. And then at some point we had a meeting, and we decided to get incorporated and eventually start to look for place. And so staying in the area for this group is the reason I stayed and let this group grow and develop. And so this, so what happened was that over time, this group grew, and the Vipassana world was a place where I really had the greatest need for me to be a teacher in. Zen has lots of Zen teachers in the Bay Area. I wasn't needed to be a Zen teacher here in the Bay Area. So I kind of got pulled in. I got kind of pulled into this world, and very happily. And so this is kind of what I do now. But the fork could have very easily gone the other direction. You know, I could have ended up being a Zen teacher, I feel. It's hard to know. I didn't, without running the experiment both ways. But I feel that this was the right thing for me. I feel this was the right, I feel very happy and content that this is the direction I took and what I do and what that thing that I champion in terms of practice the most. I feel very, very, the opportunities in doing it this way are wonderful for me. Next year, and probably in about a year from now, next February or so, the plan is to teach a 7-day retreat at our new retreat center at IRC, together with Mel Weitzman, my Zen teacher. And not to teach Zen, but not to teach Vipassana, but somehow the two of us, and with Max Ernstein, the three of us, because Max is closely connected to Mel Weitzman as well, is somehow the three of us teach the Dharma. So I don't know what it'll be like, Dharma jazz. So right behind you, one more, and then we have to stop.
Thanks.
I often wonder whether the Western Buddhism that I like so much is a new invention, or whether it, how closely it's related to what you and Jack Kornfield and Joseph Goldsmith learned in Burma and so forth. Would you talk a little bit about? And the reason that I ask that is that my experience in Southeast Asia is that most people who are Buddhists are a little bit like Mexican peasant Roman Catholics. It's a very ritualistic kind of practice. Can you talk a little bit about people that you met in Southeast Asia that have the kind of understanding that we've been taught here in the midst of this highly ritualistic Buddhism?
So to start with what you first said, it's my thesis or assumption that Buddhism gets reinvented every generation or every person. There is no Buddhism in the abstract. And it doesn't take much study in the history of Buddhism to see how much change has gone on down through the generations. And when Westerners, Americans and Europeans, went to Southeast Asia, India, to study with the focus tended to be meditation. So they tended to go to meditation monasteries. And a very small percentage of Buddhist monks and nuns in places like Thailand and Burma actually meditate. The assumption in the West is that, that's what Buddhist monks do, is they meditate a lot. But a very small percentage do. But there are meditation monasteries where there's a lot of meditation going on. And the primary, and for the most part, some of the great meditation teachers that the Westerners studied with in the 50s, 60s, 70s, did not represent the status quo of Buddhism, of their countries. It did not represent the historical continuation of the true pristine Buddhism with that unchanged for, from one generation to the next. But the teachers we studied with were the radical, progressive reformers of their time. And it wasn't obvious to many of us at the time. It was like we just took it for granted. These are venerable old teachers. They must represent what Buddhism is. But they were already involved in a radical process of transformation and change. Some of them were rationalists. Some of them were de-emphasized the ritual themselves, aspects of it. And so every generation is changing, is making the change, and it's fascinating to study that. There's an axiom of sometimes in the world of the scholastic world of religious studies, and the axiom goes like this: all religions change. Religions that admit they change die out. So I'm admitting we change. We'll see how long we last. Because I guess the point being, when you admit you change, and there's changing from one generation to the next, it's hard to take the mantle of some absolute religious authority. This is how it is. It's always been this way, and we're plugged into the absolute truth. How can absolute truth if there's change? It's changing from generation to generation. And then it raises a lot of interesting questions about the nature of certainly Buddhism and what Buddhism is, and what the difference is between what's essential about Buddhism, and how that essential aspect of Buddhism is presented and housed, the context for it. One idea is that the essence is unchanged, but how that it's expressed, how it's supported, and how it fits into any culture changes according to the culture and cultural needs, how it's expressed. Very simplistically, we have to teach Buddhism here in the West in English. And what is the English constraints of the English and the opportunities of the English language, which is different than some of the Asian languages and how it's expressed and what comes through and what's lost, what's gained, what has to be different because the language is different. So for example, a small example, then I'll stop. I apologize for going on. A lot of the English translations of ancient Buddhist texts use the word nirvana or nibbana in our tradition, nibbana. And so you see sometimes, the people use the word nirvana as a translation, and it looks like a noun. But in the many times in the Pali text, it's not a noun, it's a verb. But to say nibbanized, it kind of doesn't quite work in English. So people say attain nirvana, or, experience nibbana or something. But that misses kind of the real meaning or the connotations of to be nibbanized as a verb, as an activity, as opposed to a state. And then, so then some people focus so much on nibbana as a state, experience a state, a thing, a noun, whereas it's not supposed to be a noun, it's supposed to be an activity. And activity is one, probably the best translation, I think, that gets a sense of what this means in English, is the word release. So the to be nibbanized is to be released. Mm-hmm. So as opposed to, make sense? So this is an example of how it's a little hard in English, or this translation. So just English is hard. And then we have, cultural differences and worldview differences. And, the West has a radically different worldview than parts of Asia. And do we just jettison the Western worldview and just adopt the Asian worldview in order to make it all work Buddhism here? That doesn't make any sense. But if we keep our worldview, the Western worldview, some of it, how does it fit in? Do we just, does it translate evenly or smoothly? And do we lose something in the translation? Do we gain something in the translation? Is it one-to-one correspondence? We just have a different way of expressing it, but, in our culture. So these are very interesting questions, but if you ask too many of these questions, then you lose your audience. And I'm going to lose you now. So to sum up then, all this, it's I am extremely grateful to have discovered this practice, to walk this practice. It's been very meaningful for me to be engaged in this practice of liberation, of freedom, of compassion. And it's very meaningful for me to share it with you and share it with others. So that's the summary of the talk. Thank you all. And I have to leave relatively quickly in case a lot of people want to talk to me. I can't really do a lot today.